This is your optional series of lectures on literary theory, tied to the modes module, but actually just a general interest for the rest of your work where you're going to be here. Over the next two terms, I'm going to take you through a whole series of questions related to various movements in the history of literary criticism and the history of literary theory. In the first term, I'm going to concentrate mostly on 20th century stuff, and I'll give you, as it were, a quick guide to various movements, including formalism, American New Criticism, structuralism, Marxism, psychoanalysis, semiotics, deconstruction, etc. A whole series of things I'm going to, as it were, explain to you as best I can in an hour. In the second term, I'm going to take that back a little bit historically. In fact, I'm going to go back to some of the roots of Western literary theory, and we're going to go back to the ancient world and start at Plato. And we'll do some Plato and Aristotle and Horace and Longinus, and then we're going to make a big move to the medieval period, do some scholasticism if we've got time, move on from that into the Renaissance period and through Romanticism, and try to, as it were, fill in the back history of 20th century movements in theory. Today, though, all I really want to do is to pose for you a batch of questions that you can take away and worry about for the next 3 years or so. The first question is, what's literature? The second question is, what's criticism? And the third question is, what's theory? For many of you, I know the word theory is something that's relatively new. For many of you, it's not. For many of you, this is maybe a little bit kind of old hat. But what I want to try to do is to really get you thinking a little bit about how it is that we will engage with the stuff that you're going to be reading for the next 3 years, and to raise, as I say, a whole series of questions and problems for you. I'm assuming you can hear me at the back. You don't seem to be straining too much if I project like that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I'm still trying to measure my voice. Oh, forgive me, actually. Somebody told me that a batch of you showed up last week, thinking the lecture started last week. Sorry about that. Sorry to give you a dissy, as we used to call it in Glasgow back in the old days, where you would arrange a date with somebody and they wouldn't show up. It's embarrassing all round. Sorry, I thought we'd made it clear that these lectures began this week. So my apologies for those of you who came along last week. I'm sure you didn't waste your time. I'm sure you engaged in vigorous debate about the nature of literary theory with each other and chewed the fat and made some friends. Okay, what's literature? Let's start there. The category of literature, sometimes written with a capital L, the status of literature as a discipline in academic study suggests that you might be able to define it in some kind of way. If you were here studying medicine, you would know that the proper object of your study essentially was the human body and how it works. If you were here to study physics, you would know that the proper object of your study was the forces that hold the universe together, fundamentally. If you're here to study chemistry, you know that what you're doing is experimenting with various kinds of, not like at the weekend, you're experimenting with various kinds of chemicals and seeing what happens when you throw a lump of sodium into a vat of water, for example. You know, it explodes, so stand well back. But you know what your object of study is. Even if you're doing French, you know that what you're going to be doing is learning how to conduct yourself when you cross the channel without having to shout very loudly in English. You know that what you're going to be doing actually is saying bonjour instead of hello, that kind of thing. But in English, what is it that you're studying? What is this thing called literature? It has been a problem for many of us for a long time. It's a notorious fact that literature as a category, as a discipline, is virtually impossible to define in any useful or straightforward or agreed fashion. So our first problem as you're working your way through 3 years of this course is, what the hell are we doing? And it's a question, actually, that not only will you ask yourself sometimes at, you know, 11:30 on a Thursday night when you've got an essay due for the next morning and you're thinking, what the hell am I doing? It's a question, actually, that governments ask frequently. What the hell is it that you think you're doing? You're wasting 3 years of your life reading? Is that all you're doing? I could do that. What's so special about what you're doing? And then you get into the argument, you say, well, actually, I'm not just reading. I'm reading in a particular way. And you think, okay, well, so you're a smart reader. You're a clever clogs. You've got a bigger vocabulary than I have.
But all you're doing, as my dear mother sometimes still does it, all you're doing is reading books. When are you going to get yourself a proper job? When are you going to contribute to the economy in some kind of meaningful fashion? And it's a fraught question for many of us. It's a difficult question. The question of self-legitimation or self-justification. In earlier centuries, it wasn't quite this difficult. In earlier centuries, it might have been a bit easier, because then the word literature was spelt differently and it meant something different. It was spelt close to the French spelling littérature with three T's altogether, L-I-T-T-E-R-A-T-U-R-E, before spelling settled down into its modern modes. And when it meant, when it was spelt that way in the early modern moment, it would simply refer to things that were written down as opposed to things that were orally delivered. In other words, this was a way of distinguishing between two ways of communication, and it's appropriate for an age that's moving into print culture, whatever way it defines that print culture. It was a literate culture. And literature then really just meant everything that was written down. Now, this is interesting because this is somebody's cell. It's not mine. Hang on, I better take this call. Hello? Hello? I'm afraid not, because Mary's left her telephone in a lecture theatre and I'm in the middle of giving a lecture. And it's just not. So if you can find Mary, can you tell her that her telephone is in Ramthal 021? Okay? Thanks. Okay, right. You're welcome. Okay, bye. That's okay. Bye for now. Bye. Right. So I had it on. It's now switched off. It's all been recorded. Okay, so where was... Oh, yeah. So literature means things that are written down. Different from orisy, as we'd love to call it. You know, things that are actually spoken. So the word literature really meant something close, quite simply, to what we would now mean by literacy. Being able to read and to write. And that's useful for a period when we are moving, as I say, from an oral culture into a print culture, is maybe not quite so useful at the beginning of the 21st century, when we're moving beyond a print culture into an electronic culture that still uses the medium of print in various ways. Literature today seems to mean something slightly different. It seems to operate as a kind of exclusive category. It's trying to exclude things. Some people might argue that literature is a special kind of writing. It's not just any kind of writing. It's not the notes that you're taking right now. It's not the shopping list that you're writing surreptitiously as you're sitting at the back thinking, I really must get batteries for my telephone today. It's not the laundry list that you're writing. It's not the love letter that you're writing to your friend that you just met the other week. That's not literature, at least not yet. We tend to believe that actually this is a special form of writing. Well, some people do. Some people will say that it's writing with a very high level of imaginative content. In other words, it hasn't much to do with reality. It's not like history, but it's imaginative. Some might say it's writing whose language is in some way special, heightened, rich, more connotative than denotative, for example. And yet, when you get to a university and you start studying this thing called literature, most disciplines of English literature will allow you to, in fact, encourage you to, in fact, require you to study texts that are ostensibly factual, not imaginative. When you get to the more advanced reaches of literary study, you will look at the shopping list of various authors, the laundry list of various authors. It's called research at that stage. But really, at the beginning of your career, you will find yourself reading, for example, the poetry of John Donne. And when you read the poetry of John Donne, sometimes you will find that actually, in order to get a proper grip on this, I better read some of John Donne's sermons, the sermons that he preached from the pulpit as a priest. When you're trying to get your head around what was happening in the Renaissance moment in terms of rhetoric and style as Shakespeare was writing in the late Renaissance, you think maybe I better go and look at the writings of Sir Thomas Browne, other people who were writing factually based stuff. Or later on in the 17th century, you think, why is Dryden writing about the body in this kind of way that he's writing about in this particular poem?
Why is he doing that? What did people think about the body in those days? Let me read William Harvey, The Circulation of the Blood, for example, a scientific text. And all of that is somehow part of literature and literary study. Others yet will try to suggest this is writing which has a kind of greater value. Literature is writing that has a greater value than other forms of literature. But the kind of value in question is usually very vague. Sometimes it's aesthetic value, so it's a matter of style, for example. Sometimes it's moral value, the idea that literature is a repository of various forms of moral value. Sometimes it's propaganda value, that literature is seen to further certain political ends, and so on. Those who subscribe to the belief in literature as valued writing will usually, nonetheless, argue for some kind of intrinsic value or worth to some texts over others. And they will usually hypothesize, therefore, what they will call a canon of literature, or the proper term really is a curriculum of literature, which excludes the back of texts. So, the love letter that you're writing to your friend that you just met last week, as I say, isn't literature yet because you haven't learned really how to write poetry yet, and it's coming out in the doggerel kind of form that you associate with, I don't know, cheap Christmas cards, birthday cards, I love you more than words can say, please stay with me every day. I'm not ready to quote myself, as you can see. So what you tend to do is to say, well, no, we'll exclude that. But then, when you look at your friend sitting beside you and they're writing, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways. And you think, hang on a second there. That looks good. That, let me plagiarise that for a moment. And really, at that point, and don't plagiarise anything while you're here. My excuse to get this word in, you will be penalised. And we will find out. Because we've read everything. So, here, what you're doing is excluding various kinds of literature. Various kinds of writing, sorry, from this category. So there are clearly some important issues here. Firstly, on what possible grounds can literature be defined as such in a way that everyone will commonly agree? Then, what is implied in the act of labelling one text literary and another text non-literary? What are the value assumptions involved in even thinking this kind of way about writing? Let me move from that to a slightly different question here. English literature has not always been with us. The phrase English literature wouldn't really have meant very much to Shakespeare, across, or even Dryden, although by the time of Dryden it's beginning to mean something. For us, however, it means something because we've got a degree in it. But English literature degrees haven't been there since universities began either. English literature degrees begin really at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. Between about 1893 or thereabouts and about 1917, a group of people essentially invented the discipline that you're now studying. And those people, I mean, there were various people, but one group of people in particular in Cambridge came together. Mansfield Forbes, who was professor of history, E.M.W. Tilyard, who was professor of classics, and Annie Richards, who was professor of what we would now call psychology, moral philosophy, as it used to be called. Here, these three people got together, and they brought their specialism in these three disciplines: history, classical rhetoric, how you, as it were, engage with language, and questions of psychology. And these three things brought together allowed them to, as it were, group a whole batch of texts written in English, which then became the curriculum of the first English degrees. And we've been arguing about those degrees ever since. We're still arguing about what it is that you should be reading. And these arguments take place more or less every day, up and down the corridor, in H50 and above, the fifth floor of English. We're still arguing among ourselves about what it is that you should be teaching. So it's a very kind of mobile discipline, not a settled discipline by any stretch of the imagination, and much more importantly for our purposes, not a naturally occurring discipline. It's something that we are inventing and reinventing. In that state of affairs, given that we're inventing and reinventing the object of our concern, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that we're doing with this object of concern? Given that we can quite settle to say, we know that we're dealing with this same object, whether the physicists deal with forces, or the chemist deals with basic elements, the elements that make up the universe, or the medic deals with the human body. Given that we can't agree that we're dealing with the same thing all the time, we move on to a slightly different question. How are we dealing with this thing, whatever it may be, that we more or less broadly agree on, but don't quite fully agree on, literature? In other words, we ask ourselves the question, what is criticism? And that's what I'm going to come to now. So what is criticism? I think an easy way of going about this would be to refer you to a great book by M.H. Abrams, up in the border. M.H. Abrams, A-B-R-A-M-S, for those of you who are podcasting. M.H. Abrams, the book is called The Mirror and the Lamp. And it's a book about romantic poetry and romantic philosophy, or romantic theory, romantic critical theory. At the beginning of it, he gives us a general introduction in which he identifies, he gives us this diagram that I put on the board. He puts the word work at the centre of the diagram. Up above it, he puts the word author. Bottom left, reader. Bottom right, universe. And he says these are all kind of linked to each other. Okay, so the things all linked to each other. And he says that every act of literary criticism, every single act of literary criticism, including your own, will prioritise one of these poles, or coordinates as he calls them, one of these coordinates over the other. So, as a critic, you, when you're reading a poem, will look at the poem and you'll be aware of these four different coordinates: the author, the work, the reader, and the universe. And in your act of criticism, you will be establishing certain kinds of priorities in which one of these becomes more important than the others. So, for example, you might be the kind of critic who's reading, let me think, reading a poem, what have you read recently? A poem by Sylvia Plath, yeah? Everybody's read a poem by Sylvia Plath? Okay, you've probably all read Daddy or something, yeah? Or you've probably all read Lady Lazarus. No, actually, no, Lady Lazarus, I gather. My son tells me Lady Lazarus is banned from school because it deals with suicide. And you know, all that's wrong. Because it deals with suicide, you can't give it to adolescent children in case they think this is glorifying suicide. I think I'll go and stick my head in the oven. Form of censorship, which is not to be tolerated. Excuse me getting political for a moment, but it's just not to be tolerated. Anyway, so you've probably all read Daddy or something like it. When you come along to Daddy, you may have a very interesting relationship with your father. Okay? And you think, hang on a second, this poem was written to me. This is for me, for me. This is my poem. And really, by God, I know what this woman was going through. Because Daddy, Daddy, I'm through. You understand fully, in the sense that you emote as a reader, and that becomes your most important thing. That's what you talk about in your literary criticism. In that mode, you're prioritising the reader pole of the four coordinates. You're saying that I, as a reader, and my response as a reader is the most important element here. And that becomes your first priority. It doesn't mean you'll ignore the other thing. It just means that that's your first priority. Now, you're sitting in a seminar, and the person next to you is saying, look, don't be so daft. Don't be so self-aggrandizing. Sylvia Plath didn't know your father. Sylvia Plath is writing about Sylvia Plath. It's her emotions we're interested in. It's the way that she relates to her own father that we're interested in. What was she trying to say, as we sometimes put in this poem? What was she trying to get across? What is going on in her head? Let me see if I can psychoanalyze Sylvia Plath. And in that case, you are the kind of critic who's prioritizing the author. The person sitting next to you is a wild-eyed Trotskyite from the lunatic fringe, or a Marxist as we used to call them. Okay? And she or he is sitting there saying, you two are just so bourgeois that I can't even be bothered to begin to discuss with you. Because really, can't you see this poem is about how personal relationships are tied intimately in the family to a fascist ideology called Nazism? Can't you see that actually what she's writing about is the social formation that generates the state of affairs
between a daughter and a father. Can't you see that actually what she's writing about is Hitler and the position of the Jews in Europe in the 20th century? Can't you see all that? It's all there. And that person is prioritising the universe over the other things. And then there's somebody else sitting there kind of quiet in the corner thinking, what do I say after that? And here he comes in and says,
sorry to bother you, this is about our family.
There is, yeah.
No.
So, Shreer he comes in and says, somebody you bother you, is there a mobile phone? And you say, yes. It's called reality. Reality, who needs it? Who will write invisible and feel like there's a mobile phone? Okay, so Shreer he's sitting there quietly in the corner, and Shreer he says, actually, I think you're all wrong. I think really what we should be talking about here is the way this poem hangs together. Look at all those oo sounds. You do not do, you do not do. All that brown shoe, all that achoo, all that ooing stuff, what's that about? And it keeps coming back as a rhythmic pulse all the way through the poem. And it helps to structure the poem in terms of rhyme and rhythm. And more than that, can't you see how well the poem has been crafted in terms of how the first stanza matches the last stanza? Second stanza matches the penultimate stanza, the first two stanzas lead to the third, and so on. Can't you see how the metaphors are operating to structure the poem as an object in front of you? And that person is paying attention to the work in and of itself. And Marcus says, formalist. And ignores them. But at that point, you can't ignore each other because you've got four different points of view and you've got to debate. Now, the value of that Abrams diagram is that it's more or less right in the sense that more or less we will conform as critics to one or other of these priorities. We will take either the author's intention as our main quarry, or the reader's response, or emotional response usually, as the main matter of interest, or how the poem relates to something that Abrams calls the universe, you might call society or history, the real world, the non-literary realm, or you will take an attention to the work in and of itself. Okay? You will have noticed already, because you're very clever, that this diagram is not a neutral diagram. This diagram itself contains its own priorities, doesn't it? Because there's something that's at the centre of this diagram. There's something that's up above the centre. There are two things that are more or less equal, one to the left, one to the right, down at the bottom of the centre. So there are certain priorities apparent even in the diagram. In other words, the diagram is not itself innocent. We have to begin to realise that these things are signifying to us. Even the diagram that pretends to be a bland, general statement of affairs nonetheless contains within itself its own priorities. Now, apply to yourself. When you go home this evening, in the quiet and stillness of the room, when you're listening to, I don't know, whatever you're listening to these days, or when you're watching a movie or whatever, ask yourself, what is it that I ask myself when I read a poem? When I say poem, I just mean text. What is it that I ask myself when I read a poem? What am I after? What kind of critic am I? Am I the kind of critic who is interested in all four of these coordinates, but who prioritises the author above the others? Am I the kind of critic who prioritises my own response above the others? And once you've found not the answer to that, you won't get a settled answer. It will be, sometimes I'm interested in the author, sometimes I'm interested in the reader, I'm kind of interested in both, in a kind of mishmash kind of way. Then start asking yourself a question. Two questions. One, why am I interested in the author above all things? And two, what does that imply in a more general way? And it's that last question that's going to open up for us the question of what is theory in a moment. What is implied in my looking at a poem and saying the most important thing here is what the author is? For example, is that what you did? What is implied when you look at a poem and say the most important thing here is what the poem means to me? Jane blogs Joe Soap at 11 p.m. on the evening of Wednesday the
something from October 2008, whatever it is, in October 2008. What is implied when you ask that question of yourself? What is implied when you say, I'm interested in the way the poem holds together? Can we apply that to other things, like the way you communicate with each other, for example? So when somebody says something to you, or sends you an email, when you finish reading your poem now, you're looking at your email, and when you read the email, do you think, how is this email affecting me? Or do you think, what did the author of this email mean when she said, see you for coffee tomorrow at 11? Does she want to see me for coffee tomorrow at 11? Is that AM or PM? My luck might be in, my luck might not. Maybe she just wants coffee. It's exactly the same thing that you do when you're confronted with a literary text. But what's implied when you start asking these questions? Apart from the fact that you're kind of obsessed with certain kinds of activity, for example. So in all of these, we have to start asking ourselves the question, where are our priorities? In other words, when you pick up a literary text, what is it exactly that you're doing when you're reading it? What are you looking for in the text and in the engagement with the text? Do you ask the same questions of a Renaissance tragedy as you would do of a contemporary Alan Ayckbourn comedy? Do you ask the same things of the Alan Ayckbourn comedy as you would of a lyric poem by Seamus Heaney? Do you ask the same things of Seamus Heaney that you would ask of Jay-Z when you listen to Jay-Z? And what exactly is it that you're looking for? And why are you maybe asking different questions? The questions themselves are often dictated to you by the discipline in which you locate them. And that's one of the reasons why when you're listening to Jay-Z, you don't usually ask exactly the same questions of yourself and of Jay-Z as you would when you're listening to Seamus Heaney. Because the discipline in which you locate Jay-Z, popular music, is different from the discipline in which you locate Seamus Heaney. Highfalutin, Nobel Prize winning, probably quite difficult poetry. But should you be asking the same thing of these things? In other words, should the discipline determine what you're asking? Why can't we ask the same question of Jay-Z as we ask of Seamus Heaney when we come to read Seamus Heaney? And that's not a rhetorical question implying that you should. That's a genuine question. If you don't ask the same thing of Seamus Heaney as you ask of Jay-Z, why not? And again, what would that imply? It would imply, for instance, it seems to me, that we have an absolute divide between what we usually call popular culture on the one hand and high culture on the other. Are you happy with a society that likes that? Maybe you are. Up to you to decide. Certain kinds of response that we get to poems are often found. Oftentimes... Okay, fine. It's all happening this morning. We're now being surveyed. You're being monitored even as you speak, you know. I could get paranoid about these things, but I try not to. Anecdotally, when I read student essays, I will often find that students will value certain kinds of things, like the unity of a poem, for example, like the coherence of a poem, like the mastery of the language of a poem, like the resonance in a poem, like irony. The poet is often praised for having a sure grasp of what life is really like, and so on, all these kinds of things. And these things I want to suggest to you are cliches. They are things that you've learnt essentially to parrot. And I don't mean that in a dismissive fashion, because I've learnt to parrot this stuff that I'm giving you right now. But what kind of parrot do you want to listen to? Do you want to listen to a parrot that was teaching you when you were just learning the language at first? Or do you want to explore different kinds of possibilities for speech, different kinds of things that could be said? What I'm trying to get at here is that in the business of criticism, we need always to be profoundly sceptical. And one of the things this course is about is to show you various ways in which people have articulated that scepticism through the centuries, in particular through the 20th century. It involves a certain, quite a high degree
of self-suspicion. Suspicion about one's own motives, suspicion about what it is that one is actually thinking. As Heidegger put it for us, thinking is actually quite a difficult thing to do. Many of us believe that we're thinking, but when he asks the great question, what is it to think? And if I ask you, what is it to think? I know it's only 10:30 in the morning, in the middle of the week, and many of you are suffering like I am from a cold, but ask yourself the question, what is it to think? Not to have words going around in your head, but to think. What is it that you're doing when I give you a problem to solve? Like, for example, what is the answer to 2 plus 2? Many of you, except those who have dyscalculia, many of you will immediately have the word 4 in your mind. Did you think to get to the word 4? Almost certainly not. It's a routine, 2 plus 2 is 4, 3 plus 3 is 6, 4 plus 4 is 8, 117 plus 117 is 144. It's a routine that you go through. You don't even need to think about it anymore. Could that be called thinking? Could it be called thinking when, for example, I give you a difficult one, and I'm hoping there's no kind of mathematical genius out there, what's 1,745 plus 89? Well, give me a second, you'll say, and you'll work it out, but you'll go through a mechanical operation to work it out. As you're going through the mechanical operation, are you thinking? Or are you again falling back into routinized modes of non-reflection? Likewise, I stick a lyric poem in front of you and you go, oh yeah, yeah, another lyric poem. I know what I'm going to say. Unity, irony, firm grasp of what life really like. Write the essay, get an A as usual. What I'm asking you to do now is to drop all that. To make yourself profoundly insecure for a while. Don't worry, you'll get more secure again. But for the beginning, let's get insecure and ask ourselves, what is it fundamentally that I'm thinking when I engage with a poem? The word criticism comes to us from an old Greek root, which we would usually transliterate as krinein, K-R-I-N-E-I-N, and it means to judge or to decide. A critic is someone who's constantly having to make judgments. But in making a judgment, you need to know what are the stakes of the judgment. And you need to make sure, in this case, that it's you that's making the judgment and not some pre-existing system or code. It's not quite like a judgment in a court of law where the judge sentences the suspect to death. And the suspect says, oh, wait a wee minute, that's a bit harsh. And the judge says, because the judge is Angelo in Measure for Measure, the judge says, it is the law, not I, that's determining what the outcome is. The judge in the court of law is not allowed to act just on her or his whim. They have to observe the system of law, and the law determines what the appropriate penalty would be. In some countries, you do this act, you pay this price. Okay? So the judge, having seen that this act is tied to this individual has done it, therefore, the judge has no say in the matter. In that case, the judge is not a judge. The judge is simply a functionary of a pre-existing system of codes. That's what I'm asking you to get beyond. You've got your pre-existing system of codes. It's called your vocabulary of criticism. It's called everything that has brought you here today and made you a very good student of English literature. And now I'm saying, kick away that ladder and let's see what happens. And once you kick away the ladder, you start thinking, how the hell am I going to stay here? I'm kind of floating in midair. I'm hanging onto the roof. How do I stay here? How do I keep on going? And that is what this course of lectures is going to be trying to show you how to do. Terry Eagleton, in his book Literary Theory, has a really interesting little example here of how we engage with language. Some of us, over the years, have said, well, if we can't define literature, then maybe literature is kind of everything that's written down, as it used to be. So you're in the London Tube, and you walk into the tube, and it says, just the tube about to go down, say, dogs must be carried on the escalator. There was two of you. One of you is a literalist of the imagination. Dogs must be carried on the escalator. So you're about to go, oh, hang on, dogs must be carried on the escalator.
I better wait and see if I can get a dog before I go downstairs. Because dogs must be carried on the escalator. You can't go onto the escalator unless you're carrying a dog. The person next to you is a poet. And the person next to you is saying, no.
That's not what it means at all. As Eagleton says, one could let oneself be arrested by the abrupt minatory staccato of the first ponderous monosyllables, dogs must be. Find one's mind drifting by the time it had reached the rich elusiveness of carried to suggestive resonances of helping lame dogs through life. And perhaps even detect in the very lilt and inflection of the word escalator a miming of the rolling up and down motion of the thing itself. Two approaches to exactly the same phrase. Each a wee bit extreme. The second one you will recognise because you've done it. You've done it at various times when you thought, I cannot get what the hell this poem is about. So let me make something up. It seems to be suggesting that there's some link between the language of the poem and the rhythm of life. The escalator. Yeah, escalator. It sounds like going down escalator. Like carried. I was carried once. I was drunk last night and I was carried home and it made me feel good after my friends. It's like being a lame dog and having to require the help of other people. It's like that moment when you realise the rich elusiveness of carry. What does it mean to carry? At the one hand, it means to carry a bag. On the other hand, it means to carry oneself. It means to comport oneself. It means to wear. Porter in French. Let's get really serious about it. And at that point, you're beginning to become the desperate critic, seeking something to say. However, somewhere between these two extremes, between the literalist of imagination and the wild-eyed aesthete, let's call it that, there is something that you have to do with the phrase dogs must be carried on the escalator. You either regard it as a text, a literary text, ripe for analysis or not. And maybe not even as black and white as that. Maybe there's some gradation of texts here. Criticism means finding the right level, as it were, at which to try to engage with texts, like CCTV in operation. CCTV in operation. What might that mean? On the wall, over there. CCTV in operation. Think a little bit about it. Operation. Opera. Works. Opus. Opus. In the Latin, those of you who know Latin, meaning a work. Opera, the plural of a work. Works. CCTV is working. It's like an opera. Because we're all performing now. All the world, as we know, is a stage, and everybody's performing. So none of this is true. So when the CCTV camera records something, it's not recording the truth. It's recording a performance. So when it catches me as I'm walking through the city late at night, hitting somebody, it's not actually catching me in an act of violence. It's actually catching two performers in an act of violence. It's an act of violence. It's theatre. It's street theatre. Try defending yourself in a court of law when that comes up. But you get that from just thinking a little bit about the language. Okay, let me move to the third question here. What is theory? It used to be the case that in this discipline that you're about to embark on, it used to be the case that we thought that theory was something that you did at the end of your degree. In other words, you would spend 3 years getting a huge body of something called English literature under your belt. And at that point, I could come along to you and say, now tell me the rules that govern the making of the 17th century lyric poem. And what you were able to do, having read about 150 of these things, is to say, well, what is it these all things have all have in common? And you would begin to give me, as it were, the formula for writing a 17th century lyric poem. What is it that governs epic? Well, by the end of this year, you'll have read at least four of them. And at that point, you'll be able to give me the rules of epic. It used to be the case that we thought of theory as something that allowed us effectively to kind of taxonomize literature, to sort it out into separate categories and to give the rules that govern the making of those categories.
So it used to be the case, for example, that, you know, now most of you would know the rules of how you write a popular song. Very, very simple. First of all, you lay down a 4/4 beat. Once you've got a 4/4 beat on the drums, you stick a bass in there, and the bass sticks usually to a 12-bar blues kind of structure, but you then modify it in various ways, and we're going to need a middle 8 at some point, so let's leave that on the side for a moment. But let's get a basic verse structure up and running. You need a melody, but let me give you the chord sequence first. We'll go C major, F major, C major, G major, right, fine, because I've got that, and now I just need something that's going to kind of embellish that a little bit. It doesn't really matter what it is, because that is usually they're all the same. Every pop song is fundamentally exactly the same. And then you need some words. And they're all the same as well. I love you, you don't love me, what a drag. Or, variant two, I love you, you love me, isn't it wonderful? Okay, so you can address that up a little bit. And there you've got, you can go out there and make yourself a fortune because you know how to write a pop song. You know these rules, and it used to be the case that we thought that that was what theory was. Then we began to invert things and began to think, hang on a second, if everything that I've said in this lecture so far up to this point has some element of truth in it, and believe me, it does, I am the head of the department, therefore, so if everything's true up to a point, then actually you need a kind of theoretical disposition even before you come to a poem. You need to know what it is you're looking for when you come to the poem. And that will allow you to treat the poem differently from the way in which you treat the popular song. Or it will allow you to treat the poem differently from the way in which you treat a building that you're about to walk into. And remember, you read buildings as well. Buildings determine how it's possible to behave in certain ways. For example, the shape of this building is such that if I was doing all this from a seat somewhere out there, you would think, hang on a second, it's a bit peculiar here. Why is this guy sitting in the middle of the audience shouting at the top of his voice? If this is a lecturer, shouldn't he be down there at the front where everybody can see him at once and where he's got to move his head around to catch all of us? But in that sweep, we get the magisterial authority. That's what the whole thing's nothing to do with me. It's the architecture of the building. That's what it's supposed to show. It's supposed to show a kind of mastery of you. It's also supposed to show an embrace of you as I bring you focused onto this particular point. So you read these things as well. Here, we're getting to the point of view where when you come to read a poem, you need to know that it's a poem. But in order to have it as a poem, you need a theory of literature. In order to have a theory of literature, you need some notion of what values are. You need to have some notion of how it is that language works. In other words, you need a theoretical angle on which to hook your reading, be it author-based, work-based, reader-based, or universe-based. You need some kind of theoretical predisposition. So we now, rather than thinking that theory is something that comes after the business of reading, in which case it would be a theory of literature, we've now kind of replaced that with something that we call a theory of criticism. And that means that we have to be constantly looking at the implications of our critical acts as we're engaged in the critical acts. Okay? So, that's the kind of stuff we're going to be doing in these lectures over the next term and a half, more or less. If you want further background reading here for this kind of stuff, let me recommend to you, as an initial kind of primer, Terry Eaton's book, Literary Theory, An Introduction. That will cover quite a lot of the same terrain as I'm planning to cover. It does it in a very different fashion from the way in which I'm going to do it, but at least it will give you some background reading, so you can take a look at that if you like. There are countless readers in criticism and theory these days. You should be able to browse in more or less any of them to get an angle on the kind of things I'm going to be talking about. Next week, I'm going to move us straight into the 20th century, into something much more detailed than today, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Russian formalism with you next week. Don't worry if you don't speak Russian, neither do I, but I'm going to kind of explain how it was that a group of people began to get together and forge a particular method that allowed them to engage in literature in an extraordinarily serious fashion.